Welcome to the sixth episode of Back to School with PC. Like we've heard for the millionth time this year, this has been a quote-unquote unprecedented time. Coronavirus has hijacked our lives and altered it significantly. But we have a superhero on the show today who is helping the most affected fight back. Our guest is Milina Sanchez. She's on the show to help us make sense of the impact of the pandemic on the global economy. Milina currently works with the World Economic Forum and UNIS Social Business for the COVID Alliance to support social entrepreneurs during the crisis and its aftermath. She is also an impact investor through the Israel-affiliated Impact First Investments, investing in the brightest startups across the world, creating an equitable future. Milina holds an MBA from Tuck School of Business, Dartmouth, a master's in public administration from Harvard, and a bachelor's in economics from Yale.
Delighted to have you on the show today, Milina, and excited for our conversation ahead.
Thank you so much, Prakash, for the invitation.
Let's start off right from the beginning. So what's your story? Like, how did public policy impact investing become your calling?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So I come from a small town in southern Spain, actually from a family of farmers. And indeed, in my region, a lot of people work in greenhouses. My region's nickname is the Plastic Sea because you can see kilometers and kilometers of greenhouses made out of plastic. And as you can imagine, a farmer's income is very unstable. A virus, the weather, declining food prices, everything can have a big impact on how much money you earn in any given month. And my family experienced all these and much more, especially during the financial crisis of 2008, which was a couple of years before I was due to go to college. So from our specific experience, we couldn't refinance our greenhouses and we couldn't cover our fixed costs, let alone our variable costs, and we barely survived. And this is the experience of a farmer in Spain, imagine in many, many developing countries. For me, what was most surprising was that my father was a simple farmer. He didn't know anything about the stock market. He didn't know anything about mortgage-backed securities or housing bubbles. And yet, he suffered the consequences of systemic financial failures himself. Obviously, my father was not alone. Our extended family, our friends, everyone had a story to tell. So this personal experience sparked my interest to learn more about how financial systems work, how money flows, who has access to capital and who doesn't, and how governments can help citizens and the system generally to function properly. So here I am. Now I work, as you mentioned, with the World Economic Forum for the Social Enterprise Alliance, and as well as an impact investor.
That's a very powerful story. I'm sure a lot of people have gone through something very similar, and it's great that you've chosen a path wherein you can help a few of them. Again, going back to earlier this year, when the coronavirus first was in the news, where were you and what were you doing? And did you actually take the virus situation very seriously?
Yeah, so I was in the United States when COVID started becoming a thing, I guess. I did take it seriously in the sense that classes were canceled to begin with, so we didn't have to go to a school. We had to do everything online. And at least in New Hampshire, where I was living at the moment, it's a very rural area, so there is not a lot of population density to begin with, which helped quite a bit. But I think that people, at least in around me, were very responsible when taking the necessary steps. That being said, obviously, this was not the case for the entire United States, and now we are seeing the consequences. But at least for me, I think that people were very conscious, and you know, I tried to live to those standards as well.
Jumping into the main topic today, which is around understanding the changes post-COVID and the changes that have been caused by the whole pandemic, what do you think are the most important changes that you can pinpoint that has accelerated because of this whole situation, both the good and the bad?
I think there are three main trends, and they cut across sectors and environments. So the first one I would say is digitization. COVID has accelerated the need to adapt to the digital world, right? So what before was optional, so for example, in the professional setting, taking or not taking virtual meetings, or in your personal life, doing a virtual doctor session, now has become necessary. And obviously, digitization is not working for everyone and will not work for everyone. So some companies that might be providing physical products or services might not be able to pivot, might not be able to recover from the crisis. So it does have, you know, two sides to it. One is good in the sense that it facilitates business and service delivery in the digital world in many ways. But on the other hand, you know, there are some people that will not be able to adapt. So that's one trend. The second trend is the inward looking approach of governments these days. So countries, for good or bad reasons, it depends how each one looks at it, are looking at economic dependencies with other governments and other nations, especially during moments of crisis. So take the example of masks. Just as an example, South Korea banned the export of masks at some point, and they were not alone. More countries have taken that step. Now, in a moment of crisis, some would say that it's justifiable, but the question here is that whether after COVID, countries will continue making excuses, whether they are valid or not, to continue being nationalistic in their economic and policy approaches. We've already gone through a period of nationalism that has not ended, and I believe COVID has only accelerated it. So that's the second trend. And then the third trend is, I would say, an increasing social mindset. So more companies and citizens are taking note of the very real effects of the pandemic. And some of them were already taking note of, you know, changing consumer behaviors and changing priorities of our societies. So the COVID Alliance is an example of a response to this increasing social mindset and a stakeholder approach to reshifting our priorities as a society, specifically towards the most vulnerable people, the most vulnerable communities. And if you think about it, like in developed countries where I'm from, for example, in Europe, our governments are able to respond and support those social enterprises and those people that might have lost their jobs or that might need additional services. But in many countries, especially in developing countries, institutions are not strong enough and they don't have enough capacity to respond. So the question next is, how can we leverage that increasing social mindset and actually move from planning and from talking to action? And that's, you know, the trend that we have not yet figured out.
Cool. You've laid the whole structure down really well and pointed out to the three things that have been most affected by the whole COVID pandemic. One thing that strikes out is the whole income inequality piece. Like you said, the bigger companies are able to digitize. And even if you look at the stock market, some of the biggest companies have actually done much better. But it's basically the people who do not have access or are currently not educated enough to look at this trend and in a way able to adapt and digitize. These are the ones that are struggling. So if I have to be very blunt and ask you, what do you think can be a solution to some of these most affected people? How do you see it?
Yeah, $1 million question. I'm not going to say I have the perfect answer, but I think that, especially because it's part of my work, social enterprises are part of the solution to address these bad trends, right? Or negative consequences of the pandemic on income inequality. Because as I said before, a lot of governments don't have the capacity or resources or structures to respond and support these vulnerable communities. And social enterprises are on the front line and are delivering services that governments cannot. So how can we support social enterprises to support vulnerable communities in a way that, you know, makes them not only recover from the pandemic, but also be part of, you know, or be at the center of the new normal, the new socioeconomic system. So I think that in that sense, to respond to your question, social enterprises are one of the solutions to make sure that vulnerable communities are protected and, you know, that we address income inequality, but obviously it's not the only one.
And maybe if we double down on this, Is there an example that you could help us understand from how some of these social enterprises are helping the most vulnerable communities?
Yeah, so there is actually a social enterprise in India that received the Schwab Award for Social Entrepreneurs this year. It's called Jan Sahas. And the organization was established, I think, more than 20 years ago. And the objective or the aim of this organization was to eliminate sexual violence and forced labor, especially among excluded communities, migrants, for example. But now during COVID, they adapted to offer, you know, essential services to these communities that cannot access them. So for example, they've already provided food to more than 400,000 migrants in India during the pandemic. So this is one of the many, many examples of social enterprises who are literally on the front line helping people that are in need.
So it's very impressive that they were able to adapt so quickly because, like you rightly pointed out, migrant crisis was huge in India, and it was good that a lot of social enterprises stepped in and helped them out. So the next bit that I wanted to ask you was about the whole pandemic itself. Say in the next few months, there's a vaccine that has been found and it's going to be given to most people across. Do you think the world would go back to the normal that we knew before 2020, or it's going to be very different from how it was?
Yeah, I know there supposedly we already have some vaccines, but that's a different story. No, great question. If you think about it, it's impossible to go back to normal. Normal defined as the old normal, how we were before. So for example, to give one data point here, it was estimated that we needed $2.5 trillion per year up until 2030 to achieve the sustainable development goals. That includes, for example, ending poverty. Now with the pandemic, we need double the amount. We need $5 trillion. If we were not on track to deliver $2.5 trillion, let alone now $5 trillion. Now, a V-shaped recovery should not be a V-shape. Exactly, it should be adapted to a new normal that is more resilient and more inclusive. And this is what a lot of people, in at least in the international arena, are referring to as the Great Reset. So how would this recovery look like? A recovery that is not exactly back to the old normal? I think it requires a multi-stakeholder approach. And it requires reprioritization of policies. So for example, I believe that it should look like a stakeholder capitalism model where governments promote equitable outcomes. So thinking about wealth distribution, competition rules, where we promote green infrastructure, and corporates also promote socioeconomic outcomes. So the trend of corporations around environmental, social, and governance factors should be accelerated, and also better coordination and cooperation between countries, especially in moments of crisis, like the one that we are going through right now.
All of this sounds great on paper, but when it comes to, because it's something that most corporates or governments have not faced before, right? How equipped do you think they are in thinking about what is a more equitable future?
That's a great, great question. And yes, even if governments have not faced this specific crisis, they've faced other crises whose outcomes have been to some extent similar, right? So all the financial crises that we've gone through, you know, the outcomes have also been, you know, greater income inequality, right? So the root problems are the same. How they are accelerated, manifested, might be different with the different crises. But to your question of whether they have the right tools and will be able to face this crisis, I would say that's a pending question to be seen. I think that there is a lot of backing for the Great Reset, and people really want to focus on that. But it is not something that we can achieve in 1 year. It's not a short-term response. It's a long-term vision for how our world, you know, should work and operate. So we need a little bit of patience and more commitment to see whether we can actually realize this new vision. I'm optimistic, but I hear your skepticism there.
Fair. I mean, I think it's important to be optimistic at this point of time. And I agree with a lot of what you've said. But it's just that the whole pandemic situation itself has been a lot of confusion for a lot of people. It's not been a great time wherein people have been able to think very clearly. So I guess my skepticism comes from there. So I wanted to talk about something different from the whole pandemic situation. It's the impact in investing space, because you've been so heavily involved here. I wanted you to help our audience understand how impact investing is different from VC and PE. How do you see it?
Great. I love this question because it's at the core of making impact investing mainstream, which is one of my personal goals. Impact investing is not different from venture capital or private equity or any other asset class. It is a lens through which you can make any type of investment in any asset class. So for example, I personally invest in impact startups. That's impact investing. Other people might be providing loans to companies with certain environmental conditions. That's fixed income. It is impact investing. Other companies might be acquiring companies that are in the renewables space, private equity. That's impact investing as well. So impact investing in reality, at least at the core, is the investments in companies or asset classes that have a social environmental goal, but can also deliver financial returns. And it is asset class independent in that sense. It is also different from the typical venture philanthropy and philanthropy space in that it is not a donation. But again, to answer your question, impact investing can be applied to venture capital, private equity, and any other type of asset class.
Okay. As an investor, when you're making an investment, how do you evaluate your returns? Is it very similar to how a VC or a PE investor would look at IRRs or the net present value of an investment? Or is there something else that you also consider?
At the core, investors are investors and they do need to track their returns, right? So in my case, because I'm an impact tech venture capital investor, one of the main things that I look at when I'm talking to entrepreneurs evaluating business models is whether there is a direct link between the impact the company is trying to achieve and the product or service they are offering. So that means, for example, in the case of a healthcare startup, if I'm offering a product that increases the quality of life of people with a certain disease, the more that I sell that product or service to these patients, the more money I'm going to make, but also the more impact I'm going to make in terms of breadth of impact, right? So that link between impact and business model for us as impact tech investors means that there is no trade-off. But if you talk to a lot of other impact investors, they would say there is a trade-off between impact and returns, and they have to prioritize one or the other. In those cases, they might still be looking, you know, at IRRs and other types of financial ratios, but they would also look at impact measures and try to decide what that trade-off break-even point or breakpoint is. In our case, again, as impact tech investors, we do measure impact and we do measure returns, and it should go in lockstep. So as one increases, the other one increases as well.
Okay, cool. And maybe just to understand the opportunity itself in this space, could you put a dollar value to it, or like, how do you see it? Do you see that every VC investment going forward would be impact related? Or
I would love that to be the case. It also depends on how you define impact. And that's one of the fundamental questions of our industry as well, because a startup can be impact in the sense of being aligned to the sustainable development goals, or it could be a company that is just thinking about environmental, social, and governance factors and how to risk mitigate them, right? So there is a spectrum there. Do we consider all those companies impact? If we do, then I hope that in the near future, every company will be an impact company, because they would all be thinking about, at the very least, ESG factors. If we focus only on the SDG part of the equation, which is the part where companies are creating solutions for social or environmental challenges and are not just looking at their own sustainable operations, obviously the investable opportunity is smaller. And we've done some mapping of the industry, which is not perfect because there is not a lot of data out there, but at least one of the numbers we have is that last year in 2019 alone, there was $2 billion invested in impacted startups. And in comparison to the VC industry at large, which is $400 billion, doesn't sound like much, but the question is how fast will, you know, investments in this segment grow? And I'm quite optimistic that it will increase very rapidly, especially, you know, in the US and Europe, which are taking leading roles in impact tech venture capital.
There was something very interesting that you mentioned in your answer. One around corporates taking a lot more responsibility when it comes to ESG goals and stuff like that. Do you see that becoming mainstream, like after the whole pandemic and looking at other environment factors that are affecting people?
Of course, a lot of it. And the question is not, is there a lot or not, but is it true? Are the claims true? Are they actually walking the talk? That's a question that we are facing right now. And we call that impact washing. So a lot of companies are claiming that they care about these issues. Some of them might have some CSR, corporate social responsibility programs in place, but fundamentally at the core of the company, at the mission, and again, going back to the product or service, they are not making many changes. So the next step is to migrate all these companies that have seen the need to talk about impact and social responsibility and take them through the journey of actually doing it. And I think that the reason why they've seen the need to do it, especially over the last decade, it's, you know, on the one hand, because of consumer behavior, right? More and more people are very socially and environmentally conscious, and they actually think about whether they want to buy products from this company that has a bad image, because they've done something bad in X country or in X, you know, supply chain versus this other company that is known for being sustainable and responsible. So that's one of the primary reasons. But the other reason that I think it's becoming more apparent is that some governments, especially I would say from the European Union side, are making social and environmental actions part of the fiduciary duty of corporations. So they are making it legal, almost mandatory. And when that happens at a larger scale in other countries, companies won't have a choice. They'll need to think about these issues at the very least, but also take action on them.
That's a very interesting way to make sure that companies adhere to things. And I think that's a very positive step as well. For the final section of our talk, I wanted to speak a little more about something that the organization that you work for, World Economic Forum, and other big global institutions and their role today. Can you just talk about how do some of these institutions coordinate relief and why is it important to coordinate between different countries itself?
Yeah, so there are many ways of coordinating relief and generally response to the pandemic. I would say that the more typical approach is by one given organization to use their own resources to help, you know, for example, if it's an impact investor, their own social entrepreneurs. The next level is to form a group of organizations from the same sector to coordinate and to share learning. So for example, a specific initiative that comes to mind is from the Global Impact Investing Network, which created the R3 coalition of impact investors to understand what other impact investors are doing to facilitate more resources, more investments into social entrepreneurs during the pandemic. So for example, they would change certain conditions in the due diligence process and make it easier generally to make those investments. And then the next step is to create a group of stakeholders that are not just from one specific group like impact investors, but it's also, you know, government and policy institutions, it's also supporting intermediaries, it's also corporations, and make sure that resources are shared among all of them so that they can, you know, increase the relief deployment and coordination deployment. It is important because, you know, the more you coordinate across the stakeholders, the better you're going to be able to deliver those resources to the people that need them the most.
Maybe if I could help you understand where my question around coordination came.
Okay.
If I have to think about how the whole pandemic was playing out, there was a lot of mistrust in WHO from different people across the world because it was not very consistent, their response across things. How do you see that organizations could make sure that something like this does not happen and ensure that there's more trust from governments as well as people across in institutions which are so important for coordination?
Yeah. It is true that these international organizations can be bureaucratic, they can be inefficient, sometimes they make mistakes. Just like any company, right? Any organization. Obviously, the reach that they have, the network, the presence, right? Media presence makes them even more important and they are always on the spotlight. But, you know, let me tell you, like, these international organizations are not the only ones who make mistakes and are inefficient. What can we do about it? It's complicated because when you are managing stakeholders with very different priorities, very different agendas, it's just not an easy task to bring everyone together and to respond in a unison way. I don't have a good answer for you, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an easy task. And yeah, I don't think there is an easy solution either.
Fair. I'm sure it's a very complicated thing. And eventually, the one last thing that I wanted to talk to you about is people itself, right? Like, how can a common person contribute to the fight against the whole pandemic or even making sure that the economy is back and it's revived as quickly as possible? What are your views on it?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. It's beautiful. I think that there are two ways for, you know, the average citizen like you and me to help. The first one is, you know, professionally thinking about your skills and your expertise and how you can offer them, for example, pro bono. So for example, if you are a lawyer, can you help a company in your local community who is struggling navigate some of these new legal procedures on how to get aid from government, right? So that's something very, very concrete that a person with certain skills can do. The other one is personally donate your time, you know, help a local NGO deliver necessary food and services to vulnerable communities, to people that don't have a home, to people who might need extra food because they lost their job and cannot buy food, right? And there are lots of organizations, at least, you know, in the places that I come from, that are addressing those specific needs. There are many ways. One has to do some research. You know, it's not as easy as just saying, oh, I want to help, I don't know how. You need to do your research, talk to people that might be involved with these organizations and make it happen, walk the talk.
So I guess that's where we should end the show today, walk the talk. Thanks a lot again, Melina, for doing this. It was lovely listening to your views and there was a lot that I've taken away from the conversation and I hope that the listeners have done the same as well.
Thank you for inviting me again. It was a pleasure.